Accession number 27083, Reel 5.
So, Henry, we're going to come back, I think, at a, well, in a future moment, we're going to be talking about the intolerance question, which you've just touched on, and you've made one or two. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But can I just ask this of you, before we leave Dartmouth, did not being made a cadet captain have any impact on your immediate career after leaving Dartmouth?
I'm not sure that I can answer that, but I don't think at all, no. Because by then my father had fixed that I went to the Prince of Wales. In fact, as I'm about to describe, I didn't go there, because he did.
Yes.
Can we go on?
Yes,
no?
Please do, yes.
Well, we've dealt with that. As a result of being switched from the Prince of Wales, I was appointed to the Edinburgh. A big 6-inch cruiser, sister ship of the Belfast. And I was to join her in Scarpa Flow. And this was, I'm talking of the first week or so in January 41. And I went up by train to London with all my clobber and had to catch the night train up to Thurso. And we started off all right, but next day we spent 6 hours outside a funny little station not very far from Thurso called George Mass. For all I know, it's still there. And I was as green as grass, of course. I didn't know this route, and the train was full of people returning from short Christmas leave and that sort of thing. And it was absolutely jam-packed. We eventually clawed our way into Thurso in the late evening. And I was met by an astonishing sight, because everybody, they dropped their luggage, their kit, everything. They leapt out of the door of the train, and they ran as fast as they could down into this funny little village, where there were two so-called hotels. One was the Pentland, and the other was the Royal, I think. I may have got the names wrong. And I ran with them, because it was the thing to do, to hell with my gear, and so forth. And I ended up at one of these pubs, can't remember which, Pentland, I think. And I got a room, a very basic room, no rug or carpet on the floor, a single bed, and I shared it with a young doctor and an RNVR lieutenant. And I was a very green seniority, about 10 days, midshipman. And they behaved terribly well to me and insisted that I occupied the bed, which was jolly decent of them, and so forth. And, you know, one was tired because you hadn't slept much in the train, and you were hungry, and there was not much to get to eat. Or I don't know how, my memory is dim on that. And next day, we had to make our way, I can't remember quite how, I think we walked. And somehow somebody offloaded the train with our gear. And we walked down to Scrabster to catch the ferry to Scarpa Flow. And shortly afterwards, we put to sea. It was blowing a full gale. I was seasick and feeling utterly miserable. And I suppose about 1800 that evening, she ran alongside the Dunluce Castle, in Lyoness, which was the sort of base depot ship for Scarpa Flow. And I was feeling very tired now, and not particularly hungry because I'd been seasick and so on. And at about 2100, the Edinburgh's boat came alongside, and in charge of it was a midshipman who I had remembered at Dartmouth, a good year or so older than me, as being a particularly foul-mouthed and unpleasant specimen. And he hadn't changed a bit, and he was producing all the expletives and saying, get down on the boat, and all the rest of it, and so forth. And we went out into the flow where Edinburgh was moored, and they had a party on board in the wardroom. And by now, this was getting on for 10 o'clock, 2200 at night. And as far as one could generally judge, and of course this is a gross exaggeration, but if they weren't drunk, they were all drink-taken. And somebody thrust my first glass of gin into my hand, and it was a strong one, and unthinkingly I put it down. And there was no organization for what to do with a newly joined midshipman. There was nowhere to go to put one's gear or anything like that. Somehow I was led to a position just under the bridge, forward, where they had three bunks either side of the bridge, which were used for the lookouts off Trick. And I was put in one of those bunks. And next morning, somehow, memory absolutely blank, I found my way aft to the gunroom and got some breakfast. And somebody told me that I had the forenoon watch on the bridge, 8 to 12, and we were going out into the flow. So somehow I found my way to the bridge. Pretty well the first time I'd been on any warship's bridge, not quite, but not far off it. Milling with people, nobody at least been interested in me. And the only really identifiable and recognizable piece of kit on the bridge was the chart table with a chart. And I thought I understood about that. So I stuck my head in the chart table and gazed at the chart to see where we were going and so on. And they had a rather unpleasant navigating officer, whose name I can't recall just as well, who was furious that I was in his holy of holies and flung me out. And shortly afterwards, I was sent on a message to somewhere, and phones were ringing. And everybody said, "Smiley, answer that telephone." I didn't know where the telephone was, and there were several of them. And then I was sent on a message which took me off the bridge. Can't remember what the message was all about. And I left the bridge. And I did not return. I don't know what happened then at all. And I'm blank for the rest of my 3 days there, because by then I occupied about half, 1.5 days. And then a whole party of us were transferred to the Rodney. And the captain of the Rodney was a splendid man, Freddie Dalrymple Hamilton, who'd been our captain at Dartmouth for my first year or two there. And it was a different kettle of fish, of course, because there we were. People were towed off to generally bear leaders, look after us, nurse us if you like, and show us around and so forth, and it was all properly done and properly organized. But I had a very unhappy memory of the good ship Edinburgh. However, she was one of my nine lives, because I think not the next sortie she made, but the one after, she was sunk with heavy loss of life carrying the Norwegian bullion on board, and not very far off, somewhere up in the Pentland Firth, I think, not far off Scotland itself. Well, then...
So the Edinburgh is sitting on the bottom with a lot of Norwegian gold in it.
Yeah.
Or was that, has that been recovered?
I don't know. Because such was the loss of life that she became a war grave, and I don't know what happened about the girl.
Right.
I'm afraid. But the main thing was that the ship was sunk.
By a submarine or a mine?
I'm not sure. I think a submarine. Don't think it was a mine.
Okay.
Well, now, who else in the Rodney?
Rodney, of course, is a big battleship with 14 or 15-inch guns.
16-inch guns.
16-inch guns.
Yeah.
Is it the one with the three turrets forward?
That's right. Sister ship of the Nelson. And they were the two. They were built between the wars, and they were caught by the Washington Treaty. Do I mean Washington or London?
The Washington Treaty of 1928, was the one that...
Which limited the tonnage.
Yes.
Yeah. And they should have had another two triple turrets aft and a great expanse of quarterdeck. And they actually had a tiny quarterdeck and no armament aft at all. And the story goes that a newly joined engineer officer spent his first fortnight looking for the other eight boilers and failing to find them because they weren't there. That's all. That probably lost nothing in the telling. Well, we had... they were a good lot, I think, in the Rodney. They were still... They appeared to be largely in peacetime routine. I say that because the commander was a gunnery officer called Curly G. Grindle. Very nice man, very good. He had a son who ended up as a commodore later on. The Snotty's nurse was, i.e. the officer in charge of midshipmen, was a man called Lewis. Very nice man. Who just got a DSO for, I think, dealing with one of the earlier magnetic mines. It was that sort of stuff. But the reason I say it was a slightly sort of peacetime routine, the lieutenant commanders, of which there were quite a number, would literally fight for the privilege of working main derrick to hoist boats and things, and so on. We went to divisions every day, church parade sort of thing, every day. And we went to evening quarters in the evening at 1600 most days. Now this was very peacetime routine. And here we were, this is now January 41, we were well into the war.
That's when the whole ship, whole ship's company assembles, is that right?
Yeah.
So the whole ship's company was still assembling twice a day?
Yeah. Okay. Well, except for they're literally on watch.
Yes.
And I remember one evening, this gorgeous, sunny, warm evening, and the officers were, they'd had their tea, and they were strolling about the quarterdeck, very cramped, waiting for the bugle to go sound off evening quarters when they would have gone and taken charge of their divisions and so forth. And I can visualize him now. There was a young Royal Marines drummer, bugler. And he opened the waterproof cover of the ship's broadcast system and he switched it on, and it was then customary to go sort of to see if the circuit was alive, and a little orange light came on, and he stood back and he sounded off the bugle call for darken ship, not evening quarters. And the commander, Curly G. Grindle, was in deep conversation with some other officers, and so he heard the bugle call at the expected time and all that sort of thing. But something didn't ring quite right with him. And he was a gunnery officer, and he had a good, powerful voice. And he said, "Drummer!" And this poor little boy came staggering aft and crashed to attention and tore him off a very smart Romarine salute. "What did you sound off then?" "Evening quarter, sir." "Well, go and bloody sound it off again." Crashing salute, disappeared, flipped over the waterproof cover, stood back, and sounded off dark and trip again. At which point I thought it was about time I joined my division, so I don't know the final outcome. Well, that really is enough on Rodney. Good ship, happy ship, but I was only there for a month, and then I was transferred up in Scarpa to the Mauritius, a 6-inch Colander class cruiser, exactly the same as the Fiji, to which my chums had all gone, but now I had not. And the big difference was that the entire gunroom of Mauritius were ex-public school, and I was the only ex-Dartmouth. Not that that made any odds at all. Might have been boring for them, but but it was an interesting situation. And I will turn to Mauritius in my next instalment.
Thank you very much. Shall we break here?
Could we?
Yes. Okay.
How much have we got spare?
Sir Henry, we've had a short break. I think that you're still on the Mauritius, and you've joined a gunroom, I think, or are you now a sub-lieutenant?
No, I joined as a midshipman.
Midshipman.
It was in the spring of 1941, and in Scarpa Flow. And I suppose about a week later, we went south to
Liverpool to pick up a convoy and escort it out to Freetown. And in Liverpool was the Fiji, with all my chums on board, and I've referred to that earlier, laughing their heads off at my predicament as being the only ex-Dart in this gunroom of a public school entry. They didn't laugh for very long. Some 4 months later or so, off Crete, the Fiji was sunk and the entire gunroom was lost. So that was my second life, really, the first being Edinburgh. Mauritius was a brand new 6-inch cruiser, the Colander class, same as the Fiji. It was the early days of radar. Type 79 was the sort of masthead aerial arrangement, and it was fairly crude stuff. It told you that something was there, but and broadly speaking, how far away it was, but it wasn't very accurate. We had a good ship's company, and we had, in retrospect, we had something of a mixed bag of officers. The captain was W.D. Stevens, who was a very good ship handler, and I have to say he was extremely good and kind to us midshipmen. But he did rather go in for officers defaulters and so on. The commander was Arthur Reed Pedder, an aviator who later became a vice admiral. He was clever, but he lacked the human touch. The Snotty's nurse, in charge of midshipmen, was a Springer, a PT specialist, called Charles Godwin. Immensely kind, but thick as two planks. He was very good to us midshipmen. The sub-lieutenant of the gunroom was a chap called Weber, who was a sort of flamboyant flash Alec. I don't know what happened to him later on. He didn't get anywhere. And in those days, of course, as well as a separate gun room as a mess, there was a separate warrant officers' mess, when warrant officers wore a thin stripe or a thick stripe or even conceivably two stripes. They normally went to the wardroom then. And really, the only person of note that I would recall from the warrant officers was a certain warrant ordnance officer, the only one we had on board, whose name was Porteous. And he was an extraordinary mixture. Intellectually, he was brilliant. He was gay. He was a dipso. But he effectively invented the main destroyer's anti-aircraft fire control system, later on the flight plane. I kept watch 1 in 3 in the director control tower, situated at the back and above the bridge, as the rate officer, where you had to assess the aspect of the target and feed details of that down to the transmitting station, the computer room, to set up the fire control system. We had an RNVR lieutenant there called Greville Stevens, much older than most. I think he was up in his 40s. He was a stockbroker by trade. an extraordinarily kind, nice, gentle man, very good to the midshipmen, and very allergic, you might say, to the more stupid points of naval discipline. He, the Nazi eye to his namesake, the captain, and he used to be frightfully generous and stand people drinks and that sort of thing. One of the captain's quirks was to be very, very meticulous about the consumption of liquor by the officers, to which end he inspected the wine books, which is a perfectly normal situation, whatever it was, once a month or so. And this chap was always over the top. And the top, I think, was about £5. But then gin was tuppence a tot in those days. And this chap got warned. And he had a cabin which was very close to the wardroom, just forward of the wardroom, and it was amidships. And it was immediately abaft the after funnel. So that his cabin was really split by the funnel uptake into two halves, and it had no scuttle either side. And this man, Greville Stevens, put up his reproof from the captain for exceeding his wine bill. He had it framed in the shipwright shop, and he put it up in the after side of the after funnel and left the curtain across his cabin door always drawn back when the captain went rounds, which he did once a week. I think on balance he probably won that round. We as midshipmen, like the rest of the ship's company, it was habitual to go to dawn action stations at first light or half an hour before each morning, because we couldn't really rely on the radar, and that was the moment when you could be jumped by an enemy coming out of the murk as it got lighter. You kept watch on some bit of the armament, as well as being on the bridge at sea, and of course the usual thing, in harbour. And I had a rather interesting, incongruous experience in harbour on one occasion. The midshipman of the morning watch, from 4 o'clock in the morning to eight, the midshipman of the morning watch was not required to go on watch until 6 o'clock. And on this particular occasion, I had the morning watch, they had failed to find me. And the reason they'd failed to find me was because they'd failed to find the commander, who needed to be shaken at about that time so that he could tell off the hands for work when the hands turned to at 6:30. And the quarterdeck saw was in a flap and came to me, and they were wringing their hands. They couldn't find the commander and all that sort of stuff. So we were out in the Indian Ocean, I think, at the time. And I flung on a shirt and a pair of shorts and went up. And they were all buzzing round. They'd looked here, they'd looked there, and they couldn't find the commander. And eventually, I spotted him, and he was on a camp bed right aft on the quarterdeck. And so I went up and reported to him. And he was very sleepy. And I didn't report very vigorously, deliberately. And I counted on his getting back to sleep again. And it was then 25 past six. And the bugler sounded the G, which meant 5 minutes to hands fall in over the ship's broadcast. And I was supposed to report, coincident with that, to the commander, 5 minutes to hands fall in. And I went after the commander and said, of course he'd gone to sleep again, and said, 5 minutes to hands fall in. I then instructed the bugler not to sound off both watches until I gave him the order to do so, and summoned the chief boatswain's mate, who was the senior chief petty officer, seaman chief petty officer, and said that the commander had been delayed, although he was coming to tell the hands off for work, he'd be a few minutes late. And by this time, the commander had sort of pulled himself together and got out of his camp bed. And as soon as he was on his feet, I told the drummer to sound off, hands fall in. And he went along. And I thought, well, now, I think one's got to be a bit more circumspect about this, because somebody's going to complain that the hands have been kept hanging around, and so on. So I changed the clock in the quartermaster's lobby, and I put it back by 10 minutes. And then I thought, well, now, of course, when the commander sees this, he's going to go straight into the wardroom and see the wardroom clock. So I put that back by 10 minutes. So. And sure enough, shortly afterwards, the commander came stumbling off, still very sleepy, looking at his watch, which, of course, had not been put back by 10 minutes. Looked at the quartermaster's clock, saw that that said what it did, strode into the wardroom, saw that that said the same, remarked to me, I don't know what's the matter, every bloody clock in this ship is different. And I said, I'll send for the chief quartermaster, who is responsible for keeping the clocks in step. And that was that. I never heard any more about it. And before I finally left the ship, I admitted it to him. Well, now, those early days, most of our time was spent on convoys, which we took down to Freetown in West Africa. Not much of a place. It had a fairly robust pier, mainly of iron pylons and so forth. And about 3 miles away, there was an enormous expanse of lovely sandy beach called Lumley Beach. And there was really nothing for the sailor to do when he went ashore. There was beer that you could get from a rather ad hoc local canteen, and that wasn't much good because it being pretty well on the equator, the beer had some special preservative in it, which had the effect of somewhat strengthening it. Jack paid little attention to this. As far as he was concerned, beer was beer, and he drank it accordingly. And so there was a certain amount of drunkenness. And I remember on one occasion,